Hello, everybody. I hope everybody can see me and hear me. I think my role in this session is limited, really, not so much to a tee up as to getting the golf balls out of the bag and putting them in a place where they can be placed on the tee. And I'd just like to briefly run through some points that I'm sure many of you are familiar with about why it is that intangibles continue to be a source of concern, and what we thought that we might bring to the party to try to contribute to a willingness to address the problem.
Andrew, can I check, are the slides presenting? Can you see them?
I can see very much the title slide. I'd like to move on at least.
Yeah, I'm just making sure it's working okay. So everyone can see them, can they?
Yep. Could I move on to the next slide? One of the interesting features is that intangibles have been a rod with which to beat conventional financial reporting standards for a very long time. You can notice that from the basis for conclusions for IAS 38, which is reproduced on slide one. Which I think shows that at that time, the IESC, the predecessor body to the IESB, was kind of struggling with it and sort of in two minds and found it quite a tricky issue to deal with. One of my favourite quotes is on slide two, which is from Skinner, an article published by Skinner, I think in ABR, although I wouldn't claim total authority for that, in which he says over the 15 years or so, the economy has changed in fundamental ways. The business is now fundamentally knowledge-based. And that's sort of interesting to me because the date is 2008 and I have to keep reminding myself that 2008 is now more than a decade ago, but it is a long time ago. And he talks about over the last 15 years or so. Well, we're now 10 years further on, so it's at least over the last 25 years. And indeed, it's not too difficult to go back much further and find that complaints about the way that intangibles are reflected in financial statements are inadequate, have been ongoing for a very long time. And if we can move to slide three now, there's been some more recent criticisms, and perhaps the sort of most outstanding or the most widely known work on that is the book published by Levin Gu, which was rather dramatically entitled The End of Accounting. And they said, oh, intangibles are increasingly important, as if we didn't know that, and that financial reporting, by and large and as a generality, does not reflect intangibles, at least in the balance sheet. And the priority given to the balance sheet is sort of highlighted by a concentration, and it's a very common criticism, on the divergence between book and market values, and hence a claimed irrelevancy of financial statements to that what matters in the stock market. Now, I must admit that views differ about the validity of that last point. Some people think it's terribly informative and important. Other people take a more, slightly more sceptical view and say, well, we never thought we were trying to report the market value of the firm. That's for the market to do. And therefore, we're not completely convinced by that argument. But nonetheless, it is an argument which is universal in the literature, I would say. So there's been this rising trend of criticism And whether it's well-founded or not, and I think there are reasons to suppose that much of it is well-founded, two things I would notice. One is that some of the papers or books that have been written about the subject, although they start off very dramatically and say, well, accounting is just completely hopeless, sometimes their proposed solutions are actually remarkably mild. I mean, very few of them. I haven't seen one, I think I can say, which says, well, we need a new conceptual framework, or we need to abandon financial accounting and let's do something completely different. Usually they suggest relatively modest proposals to try to improve the situation, but you don't get there unless you've got the energy to get through the entire paper or book, which is slightly odd contrast certainly with the title of The End of Accounting. The other remarkable feature is that on the whole, standard setters have been remarkably unresponsive to all this criticism. They've tried to be defensive about where they are and what their existing solutions are, but they haven't actually made any attempt to try to rethink things from a fundamental perspective or to see what can be done. So I think a lot of our motivation, and the most important motivation, was to try to get intangibles out of what I've described on the slide as the too difficult tray. In other words, things that might be something we could do sometime, but no idea how to go about it now, into the let's think about it tray and what can be done, without, I think, on the whole, disrupting the basic role of financial statements and without rewriting the conceptual framework. I don't think, given the relatively recent publication of the IESB's new conceptual framework, many of us would particularly relish the idea of doing that, which might come to radically different answers. So I think there are three broad classes of issues that we address within the paper. The first is, given our existing model of financial statements founded on the double entry system, what can we do within that? Is where we are quite where we would ideally like to be? The second point we highlight is the role of intangibles within the entity's business model. That is to say that, you know, is it something you're going to use? Is it something you're not going to use? And perhaps arguably might be better reported therefore at fair value rather than value in use. And also we take a look at narrative reporting, which I think is particularly important in this context, because many of the intangibles, and I use the word intangibles rather than intangible assets, because many of the things that concern people most, for example, employee morale or customer loyalty, are quite tricky to fit within our existing notions of the definition and recognition criteria for assets, but nonetheless are things that people want information on. So that's basically why we wrote the paper, and we hope that, as I say, it might motivate some willingness on the part of standard setters to say, well, actually, there are at least some things we can do that will be more informative to investors and will therefore improve financial reporting. And with that, I'll hand over to Stephen to try to put some more intellectual content onto the rather obvious points that I've made.
Thank you very much, Andrew, and good morning to everyone. Andrew, I'm going to ask you to advance the slides. I don't think I have control. Okay, so thank you for that introduction. My job is to set up the thinking. The heart of this paper is in the suggested solutions. My job, I think, is to set up some of the thinking behind those solutions. We have chosen not to come down particularly on a solution, though you may infer from out reading the paper some preference there. It's just to give suggested solutions. And this presentation is actually behind the thinking that you have to consider when you come to each of those solutions. Next slide, please. Oh, sorry. Now, first of all, Andrew said that we were really working within the conceptual framework here. We're not going outside of that, particularly with radical solutions to change the way accounting's done. And so you'll see that we're in the paper, we're adopting really the objectives of the conceptual framework to provide information about the amount, timing, and uncertainty of future cash flows and about management's performance and custodianship. And you'll see throughout the paper the references to those objectives and what we propose or discuss being consistent with those objectives. I would just like you to to notice the word uncertainty. Information about the uncertainty of future cash flows, which we feel is not emphasized enough in the discussion in standards, because that's going to come to the fore as we proceed. Okay, next slide, please, Andrew. Okay, so as I said, we're working within the system. It's a double entry system, okay? Notably that it has both a balance sheet and an income statement. A lot of proposals for investor accounting for intangible assets, including Baruch Lev in that book that Andrew referenced, is accounting for it in the balance sheet. Let's get intangible assets on the balance sheet. And really the heart of our thinking is to indicate that there are two things here. There's an income statement and a balance sheet, and what you do in the balance sheet has implications for the income statement. The double entry system has features, admirable features, that we should recognize that can be exploited for communicating the value of intangible assets. And when I talk about the value of intangible assets or assets jointly, I'm talking about information about the amount, timing, and an uncertainty of future cash flows. But actually, it constrains us. There's certain things you can't do within the double entry system, and those need to be recognized, which of course calls into the question of whether accounting should be in a double entry system. But we're very much talking about accounting within the double entry system. Next slide, please. So we're just going to go through a number of features of this system to indicate the extent which the double entry system of income statements and balance sheets aid the accounting for intangible assets and to the extent to which they don't. Okay. Now, the first thing is we've come to the conclusion in this double entry system that the value of intangible assets cannot be communicated by the balance sheets. And there's quite a discussion in the paper about how accounting represents the business and what the double entry system can do in terms of representing that business. And what we observe is that with few exceptions, maybe a few of some financial instruments, there is no standalone value for any assets. Assets are employed jointly. A brand works with the plant to produce the product which the brand is promoting. Knowledge capital, human capital, even fixed assets, they're all employed jointly. And really a business is really, what's behind business is an entrepreneurial idea to get a competitive advantage An entrepreneurial idea involves understanding how you might use assets jointly to add value for the investors or to future cash flows, if you wish. So that value, the double entry system cannot communicate in a balance sheet, is our conclusion. That the sum of some value of individual assets does not total to, on a balance sheet, to the value of the assets used jointly. We as accountants are familiar with this allocation problem. This is an impossibility to actually establish the joint value. So next slide, please. Next slide, okay. Okay, so the second feature we want to emphasize is in the double entry system, for every debit, there must be a credit. When you book an asset to the balance sheet, you have to put in a credit entry. And that requires you as an accountant or a standard setter to actually have an interpretation for that credit. So if, for example, we actually booked the value of organizational capital, social capital, you live in a country with good laws, political capital, you have connections to politicians, your location is on 52nd and Madison or Oxford and Regent Street, put those on the balance sheet as intangible assets, which we reckon to some extent they are, you've got to have a credit. And so that requires you to have some interpretation of that credit. Is it income? Well, I'm not sure. What label do we put on that? Is it equity, addition to equity? Well, if it's addition to equity, we've got a problem because now the value of that intangible asset is going to come through the income statement, which is then going to get added to equity, which of course can be double counting. So we see that actually is a constraint on recognized assets that these books say organizational capital, social capital, political capital, it's not recognized in the accounting. We see a problem from this in double entry system. Unless you can put a label on that credit, you're not fulfilling the requirements of the double entry system. Next slide. So we come to the conclusion that within the double entry system, assets, and I think we can talk about assets generally here, because I think the same principles apply to intangible assets as they do to tangible assets as they do to intangible assets. We think the accounting has got to be limited to expenditures. There has to be a credit. If you have an expenditure, the credit is to cash or kind, or a liability to pay for cash or kind. You have an expenditure, you credit cash, you recognize the asset. We see in the double entry system, unless you can come up with some name for that credit for recognizing political capital, that you're going to be limited to expenditures. That's familiar to us, of course. And indeed, if you read Baruch Lev's writings, he actually limits, and many people who advocate booking intangible assets, they recognize, they limit it to actually expenditures, investments in intangible assets. And we think that's the limitation of the systems. Having said that, point four here is that we have the question of separability. That is, many of these expenditures are made jointly with current expenses to be matched to revenues. So you may in fact invest in employees by giving them bonus to retain them along with their paycheck for current employment, separating out the asset component of that transaction is very, very difficult for an accountant. Maybe more work could be done on this, but that we see that as a very difficult problem. And so for advertising can be for generating future revenues, an asset, or could actually be for supporting current revenues of this year, a periodic expense. Customer loyalty programs, developing supply chains, distribution systems. These are usually done jointly with current expenditures, current expenses, and that require that in our mind is a constraint on recognizing intangible assets. This is the problem we have. We have when we wonder how much of SG&A is actually assets and how much is expenses. The standard accountants lump them all together, and it's a question of unlumping. That's a very difficult problem. By the way, I have a problem with my camera. It comes on and off, so that's why I'm always clicking on in and out on the video here. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so we've come to the conclusion that the value of intangible assets, about what they tell you about future cash flows, cannot be communicated by the balance sheet. But there's a wonderful feature of the double entry system that there's not just a balance sheet, there's an income statement. And actually, I think that's one of the beauties of the double entry system, that the income statement supplies a number from using assets jointly, one number. It's called earnings. We as accountants have some difficulty measuring that number, but there, in principle, there's a number there. Even if assets are not on the balance sheet, we get the income from the assets coming through the income statement in their combinations with assets that are on the balance sheet, and all those other intangible assets are not on the balance sheet. This, we feel, can be should be recognized and be exploited in terms of the accounting. And so we say, look, we can't really think about investing in accounting for intangible assets in the balance sheet without understanding what the effects are going to be for the income statement. And of course, the effect of the income statement is if you capitalize the asset, then you have the problem of amortization. And that amortization is going to be helpful to your income statement in terms of getting you a measure of value added, revenues minus expenses, or it can actually be quite destructive to the income statement if that amortization is not a very good amortization. If you book an asset to the balance sheet, you have to ex ante establish amortization schedule, and you will have to do that with thinking about what is going to be an effect on the future earnings that I report. Next slide, please. And now we come to uncertainty, the uncertainty about future cash flows. This amortization, if we put assets on the balance sheet, this amortization and the error in the income statement from poor amortization is going to be related to uncertainty. What is the amortization rate for future against future revenues for R&D into a drug remedy, where actually it may not pay off? There's no product yet, there's no customers, there's no revenues. This may not work. If the probability of success is only 1%, the probability of future impairment is 99%. Rational expectation says maybe you should impair this now. But at least it's going to be very difficult to establish an amortization schedule, and that is going to be determined by the amount of uncertainty. Next slide, please. So here's the punchline, and I'll get out of your way and hand over to Richard. Asset recognition is constrained to separable expenditures, but that recognition must be made with regard to the effect on the income statement. Amortization of capitalized intangible assets can really upset the income statement if, in fact, what's going to happen is you're going to have very bad amortizations and destroy the income statement, or you're going to have impairments all over the place, always impairing these things to correct the amortization schedule, or changing the amortization schedule. This becomes a very messy income statement. However, expensing immediately and not putting on the income statement also affects the income statement. And of course, that has got to be recognized. So therein lies the tension. And that is really at the heart of of thinking about this tension is really at the heart of our suggested solutions, which Richard is now going to talk about. Thank you very much.
I'm sorry, I was muted. So you've already delivered the punchline, Stephen. So this is the less funny bit to carry on now. So when we say solutions in this paper, what we have in mind is not the answer. What we're doing is setting out the list of possible solutions that are in principle available within the constraint of a double entry system. And there are four of them that you expense. The investment in intangibles is expensed right away, or you create an asset right away, or instead you have some sort of threshold for recognition of an asset. And the fourth possibility, conditional capitalization, relates to the third. I'll come to that at the end. So the first in principle possibility is expensing. Now this of course is the practical default whenever the investment component of the expenditure cannot be separately identified, which Stephen's already mentioned. If you can separately identify, then expensing has the following characteristics. The first is that it is a response to potential overstatement of assets and therefore future mismatching under conditions of high outcome uncertainty. This is the example that Stephen just gave. So in your research and development example where there's a 1% chance of payoff, you either take the expense
or other authors, you've got 5 minutes left.
Okay. You either take the expense now or you have an impairment waiting to happen and therefore a mismatch in the future. The second point is that expensing on the flip side can also lead to mismatching that frustrates valuation based on earnings. So if you expense prematurely, as it were, and you end up with mismatching as a result, then you have expenses in this period's income statement that I mean, you don't have a sustainable measure of earnings in this year's income statement. To some extent, you can alleviate that with separate income statement presentation. Here's an illustration. This is Facebook. So notice the cost of revenue line here varies directly with revenue. The gross margin is pretty stable. But the R&D line and the marketing line contain a very large amount of money. Who knows quite how much, 15 billion, 20 million, 20 billion, which, you know, in principle, if you were to take it out of this year's income statement, would not affect this year's revenue because it's an investment in future revenues. So you have a fundamental mismatching and no information to the analyst in being able to separate the mismatched expense. So that's expensing. Creating an asset, again, you have to have separate identifiability in order for the recognition of an asset to be possible. This, as described by Andrew, is the most common sort of solution, as it were, to the problem of an unrecognized intangibles. But again, to take the R&D example, if there's a high probability of impairment, then recognition is dubious. Moreover, and this is picking up on Stephen's point, the standalone value of an asset is conceptually problematic. Assets create value jointly. Measurement is therefore typically at cost, and that suggests that information is provided by the income statement. It's the recognition of the cost, the amortization and or the impairment, and thereby the measurement of earnings and thereby the projection of earnings and thereby valuation through which the asset provides information, not the balance sheet. Now, if there's high outcome uncertainty and if you recognize the asset on the balance sheet, then there will be income statement mismatching, which is either in the form of arbitrary allocation, you just write the thing off periodically over a period of time, get rid of the asset, as it were, but in an arbitrary way that doesn't correspond with revenue in individual periods. This is the sort of goodwill amortization example in particular. Or you have, and analysts will add that number back and they'll ignore it, or you have, in a sense, an expected impairment. You know, you have an asset that is not, as it were, really an asset, and so there'll be a mismatched impairment. The third possibility, and this in a sense describes accounting practice, you have a threshold for capitalization. Again, there has to be separate identification of the expenditure that's possible, and you recognize an asset when this is referring now to the Barker and Penman paper that was in a previous forum, you recognise an asset when there is an ex ante, a relatively speaking reliable amortisation schedule. And in a sense, that describes current accounting practice. And balance sheet recognition, again, therefore, is primarily with a view to providing information through the income statement. And this aligns with the concept of control in the framework and with the role that uncertainty plays in the recognition of assets in the framework. Conditional capitalization, I recognize we're running short on time, and so conditional, and I can't mute you, I don't think, so conditional capitalization requires that you maintain separate presentation of investment in intangibles in the income statement. So you have a sort of separate section of the income statement. And you know, you expense when you fail to meet the threshold for capitalization. But then as time passes by, if you meet the threshold, then in effect you reverse the income statement presentation, create the asset, and then you are able to match the cost, the investment cost, with the revenue it generates in periods from that period onwards. And the accumulated balance, the accumulations through the income statement of amounts that remain expensed, as it were, are evidence of abandoned investments or continued investments that have yet, where uncertainty is yet to be proven. So there's incremental information in there beyond just the current practice of write it off and once it's gone, it's gone. And this aligns with reporting information off the balance sheet. Very briefly, to give Alan some time, the implication of putting three...
I'm afraid you've only got a minute, so you'll have to give him very little time.
All right, Alan, off you go. Over to you.
Okay, thanks, Richard. What I suggest we do is quite a few practical examples of existing guidance, for example, that I think I will forget those for the moment because we can discuss those potentially in the Q&A session. But just to make a couple of points, the new framework, for example, has implications for this as well. The framework has a rights approach to assets. All rights are by definition intangible. And one of the core messages in this paper is that tangibility and intangibility is not a characteristic that really should be driving the accounting. It's about the attributes of the assets, the risks, and so on. The second thing is that the framework's also moved away from asset recognition, in that if you have an asset exists, you recognize it and all the uncertainty goes into measurement. And that hands over to almost towards the conditional capitalization that Richard's described in there. And we have some examples that if we get a chance in the Q&A, I'll go through where we actually see some assets that almost have identical characteristics being accounted for quite differently depending on whether they fall within IAS 16 or IAS 38 because of the way the recognition and measurement criteria are written. So perhaps, Richard, if you just want to summarise then.
We can get those into the conversation, I'm sure. Do you want to mention that? That's useful, Alan. Do you want to refer to that in the 30 seconds before I'm finished?
Yeah, just if you have a look, the extreme is expense, which is cash accounting, essentially. And on the other end is to recognise everything as an asset. And so having a look through, IAS 38 essentially takes you quite clearly towards expense in terms of the thresholds and the additional six recognition criteria that are there. IAS 16 tends to be a little bit further towards asset. 16 and 38 together. But then we have a whole lot of situations with inventory exploration. The ISB looked at exploration last week. They essentially do conditional capitalization.
Alan,
because
I'm
of
sorry, I need to stop you there. Sorry. I'm sure we can come back in the Q&A and let you explain a bit more about that. I mean, it was a fascinating presentation. Thank you. A lot to think about. I'll now hand over to Nicholas for the academic discussion. And please keep the questions coming in.